Welcome, welcome, welcome. It's another day, it's another dollar, it's another episode of Bitches on Comics. I am your host, Sarah Century, and yet, only one among many hosts.
I think it's just two today. But hi, I'm Essie Fleenwer. I'm another of the many hosts.
Yeah, many. Like the host, the heavenly host, right? Like there's a whole bunch of them. They're here with us, Essie.
This just makes me think about this day. Korean movie called The Host, which is a monster movie. I don't know. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yay. The host is here, actually. The host.
It's a whole different host. Whole nother thing. Well, you've already heard the lovely voice of our guest. I'm so fucking pumped. Today we have our friend, someone we've had the pleasure of publishing, and the author of Liar, Dreamer, Thief, out soon. Maria Dong is here with us. Hi, Maria.
Oh my God, hi. I'm the biggest fan. I didn't even read comics until I started listening to your podcast. And then I was like, oh, they make them sound amazing. I should probably see what this is all about. I've started actually reading them on my phone, of all things, which is terrible. But
yeah.
Oh, I read on my phone too. Sometimes it hurts my eyes, but
yeah, you got to do a mix these days.
Yeah. Well, there's so much that's just digital these days. Well, obviously, compared to when comics were first being made. And I'm fired.
You reading comics because we said comics are neat is probably the nicest thing that I can imagine somebody saying. So I'm going to crawl under the table right now.
Have a good cry. No, for sure. I mean, that's why we started the pod was like, we were talking to someone about it today. We were talking about the origins of the pod, and it was kind of trippy.
BOC.
We're like, oh, right. Origins. We started before there was a pandemic. And, you know, we talked a lot about, when we were starting it, our goal being to make it a more welcoming place to start, because it can feel so much like, oh, you have to have already read for 30 years, which Sarah has done.
Right.
But you really don't. You don't. Like, neither of us thinks that. It's more like, do you have a tolerance for not quite knowing what's going on? Then you can read comics.
And also my book. No, I'm sorry.
Right. The perfect segue to...
I just think it's my brand. That's all. It was like, oh, yeah, no wonder I love this.
That does track. That does track. Well, Maria, will you just introduce yourself briefly so our listeners can know who you are?
Okay. My name is Maria Dong. I'm a queer Korean American mixed race writer. I had to think, writer, that's the word I want. My book, Liar, Dreamer, Thief, comes out January 10th from Grand Central. It's technically a psychological suspense, although there's some kind of like borderline fantasy elements and a bunch of other genres kind of crammed in there because I lack focus. And I recently had a short piece published in the Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy, which just came out. So if you pick that book up, I'll be in there kind of toward the back. And I don't know, anything else interesting about me? Probably not. So sorry.
Oh, here's two big accolades, but whatever. I guess I'm published in the Best American, whatever.
Those anthologies are huge. I remember whenever I was a kid, I believe it was Fantasy and Horror, that they had a collection that ran for years and years. It might still be running, but it was this huge book. And I was like 10 years old, rural area, like nothing was getting to me.
Yes.
Like, send the mail. I need books. And it was basically like you could always get those. And my family didn't read them, so they didn't know how adult subject matter they were. So I just got these like really cool books, and I think they were just all really happy that I was reading. So I want to say that those get everywhere. And so that's like, for me personally, that just reminds me of being a little kid and being like, oh, now I can like read Kelly Link, and I can read, you know, like reading all of the people that you would find in these anthologies.
Yes. It is scary to look at the table of contents and see. I actually have not managed to read the whole thing yet because I told myself I wasn't going to read it until it was published. I don't know why. It was like some magical thinking, because that's a thing that I do, which you may know if you've read my book. And I couldn't read it until it came out because for some reason, I don't know why. And it is scary to see all of the names and, but it's kind of the same thing. Like when I was young, there I wasn't in this like super happening area. I'm not like from New York City or California or something. And those were some of the first like books that I could get my hands on and actually start learning these names and kind of learning like the ropes of this particular kind of fiction. So it was a big deal. I was really excited. But also everything in publishing happens so long after like you find out about the thing that like, and I have the attention span of like, I want to say a goldfish, but goldfish actually have much better attention spans than I do. So like, yeah. So like now the thing is happening, but I've already moved on in my mind because, you know, I was excited when it happened originally. You know what I'm saying? I'm sorry. You're going to have to cut.
No, I know exactly what. No. That's staying in. Get over it. That's because golden. That is you're exactly how I feel too.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, oh my God, I'm so excited. I can tell no one.
Yes. That's my whole life. And it's also really bad because I have a terrible memory, like I mentioned. And so something that'll happen a lot. So I just got this email from Lightspeed Magazine because I have a novelette that's coming out in there pretty soon. And I was looking at it and I was like, the title of the story is called The Fifth Day Man. And I was like, The Fifth Day Man, what's that? Like, I wrote this story and I had no idea what it was, right? And so I had to like go through my email and I was like, oh yeah, it's a novelette that I wrote. But like, I didn't remember that. So super fun.
Too real.
Yeah.
Every now and then someone will be like, oh, tell me about the book you wrote. And I'm like, oh, what? I don't know what it's about. I wrote it. You read it. You tell me what it's about.
Yes.
Maybe not the best marketing.
You're about to see that happen in real life, just so you know.
And on that note, tell me everything.
Oh no.
Just kidding. So okay.
It's gonna
so
be like drunk history.
Of yourself. That's the funniest thing I've ever heard. Trying to be drunk history, but it's just your own personal history.
It's a true statement. I stand by it. It's real bad. I was on a call with my team. Like we had like the publicity and marketing and editor, everything. Like they're all together on this big call. And one of them said to me, I was so surprised by the big twist in the book. And I was like, what's the twist? And she was like, what do you mean? Like you wrote it and she kind of told me and I was like, oh yeah, that does happen. But like, I forgot, even though I had by at this point read and edited this book with my team, probably like 15 times at this point, like we did a lot of drafts. And even then, like my memory, that's where it's at. So yeah, it was embarrassing.
Well, this should be fun. So Liar, Dreamer, Thief, that's a book you wrote. I don't know if you remember.
And well, I do see my name on it. So I think I did write it.
You're like, I believe it.
Yeah.
I do believe it. You know, I'm really curious, like how, it's so hard to know where to start because I know you just a little bit too well. So I have like 53 places I want to start this conversation.
Oh my God, I love it. That's how my brain works. So it's awesome.
You know, so I'll throw all 53 at you and then you just answer them in whatever order.
Yes, it'll
right.
be like dodgeball. I'm in. Let's do it.
Question.
I'm like sitting up straight now, like I'm actually about to play dodgeball. I'm ready.
Listeners are like, can SA do something other than just laugh? And the answer is no. In fact, I cannot. Not when Maria's here.
I'm so sorry.
Oh my God. Okay, so talk to me about like, I'm just not sure what doors this will open. So where did this book start?
I actually have a canned response for this, but I'm going to uncan it just for this podcast.
Ooh.
Yeah.
When
I wrote this book, I was very, very frustrated. So I'm actually a science fiction and fantasy writer. That's how I see myself in my head. I never thought I was going to write like something that's going to be like commercial suspense, right? That's just not like my brand, quote unquote. And it already had quite a bit of sales in the short fiction realm. I got my agent for a fantasy book. So I just kind of assumed that that's where I was going to wind up. But the market for science fiction and fantasy is very, very tight. There's only like 4 or 5 major imprints that are taking it. There are a couple of indie houses, but they don't have like the same probably like clout and distribution that you see in like literary independent houses, for example. Like we don't have like, you know, Grey Wolf and all that stuff. So it's a very tight market. And that means when you go out with a book, there's like a very limited number of editors you can go out to. So we went out with this fantasy novel and there's like a pandemic that happens in the novel. And then like halfway through the first round on submission, COVID happened. And that was bad because, of course, publishers were not super interested in buying a book about like a magical pandemic during a magical pandemic. Like that's not, or no, during a real pandemic. I'm sorry. So that's like,
I was like, okay, what part of it was magical? Because I'm going to need more information.
Yeah. Sorry about that. So that didn't go well. And I got some very lovely passes that were like, we would have purchased this book, but we are in a pandemic and we can't. And so then I wrote a science fiction, and it was, it's probably like actually looking at it now, I'm like, oh, it's a suspense. Cause everything I write tends to be a suspense. I have ADHD, and the most interesting thing in the world to me is like, what is happening? Like curiosity, right? So like, that's the main driver for most of the characters in my books. That's the main driver for me writing a book. My agent at one point asked me to like write a treatment for a book that I hadn't written yet, so we could try to sell that. And I was like, I can't do that because I don't actually know what my books are going to be about until I've actually written them, or like what genre they're going to be in, or any piece of it. So she was like a little bit disappointed, but she understood because she's seen me work, right? So so I write a science fiction book. It goes out to like the same four or five people, or, you know, imprints, and it doesn't sell because science fiction is very, very tough, particularly as a debut, and particularly if it doesn't have certain aspects in it. Like, if you can do like a romance angle, sometimes that'll sell better because, you know, there's places in the market that are like, it kind of has that crossover appeal, things like that. But anyway, it didn't. So doesn't sell. And then my agent's like, here's the deal. We have this. So I write another book. It's like a pseudo neo-Victorian best friends become lovers, gay old ladies kind of book with like a magical opera. And they're also like just doing a bunch of capers. And I really love this book. And she really loved this book. And she was like, okay, but here's the problem. It's like, we're going to go out to the exact same people, and it's not a lot of people. And do you think you have a book in you that's not science fiction and fantasy? Like, can we go out to like a broader audience to start with and kind of work our way back into like different genres and things like that? And I was like, absolutely not. Like, I could totally not write something that's not science fiction or fantasy. And then I was like laying there 2 days later, and in my head, I just got the image of this person like jumping off a bridge. And I was like, well, now I need to know why that's happening. And I just assumed it was like a fantasy book. And then I was like writing it. And it was not. And it was a horrible, horrible book to write. The first draft was horrible. Like, I actually really hated it the entire way until about like 80,000 words in. I just, like, it wasn't going anywhere. I didn't like it. It was very arduous. I was really bored. And then I wrote the first like kitchen door scene almost at the very end of the book. And I was like, oh, this is actually what the book is about, right? Like, this is like the linchpin of the whole book. So then I had to go back and start the book over. And I did. I started the book over and wrote like a whole new first draft. And then that's what eventually became my debut. So yeah, I think that's probably a little too honest. Like, I probably should have polished that story up a little bit better. Particularly like the bitter frustration part and all the failure, but like, it's a true story, right? Like, that's, and this last couple of years has been really hard in publishing generally. A lot of people, because publishers, like when COVID happened, they started pushing their schedules out. So books that were supposed to come out in the spring would go out, like, they were like, no, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. So they pushed them back 6 months or a year. And so they weren't taking new books because they were already pushing books back. So I think a big piece of it is also just timing. You know, by the time I had written yet another book, like, the market was in a lot of a better place. And it's also like, psychological suspense is like a big commercial genre, right? Oh, there are a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that was also very helpful. And the funny thing is, coming from a fantasy background, I think really helped me because it is, I think, in some ways a little bit unique for the genre because it doesn't, I don't know how to put this, but it's employing some tropes that you might see more in like the fantasy space than in the psychological suspense space. And people are like, oh, it's so original. And I was like really surprised by that because I was like, oh, this is very ordinary and normal. But when you move something out of one genre and put it into a different genre, it does like hit different, right? So, yes. Did that answer your question? I don't remember what your question was.
Oh, yeah, no. Okay. It definitely did. I asked where it came from. And oh, you were yeah. Like, let me tell you. Okay, so in your acknowledgments, you start with, when publication takes 20 plus years and 20 plus manuscripts, there are a lot of people to thank. And I think, I actually have read that acknowledgement to friends before who have been like,
oh, whoa.
Oh my God, this story didn't get published. This screenplay didn't get picked up. This novel, like, I'm trying so hard. And I think of you as one of the most, I don't know, stubborn motherfuckers on the planet. Like, you were like, no, fine, I will write another goddamn book. Like, you just were like, I wrote this book, they didn't like, I wrote this book, they didn't want, I wrote this book, they didn't want, and then I wrote this book by accident, and here we are. And I'm like, oh my God, Maria. And so I guess I have like a bunch of different questions there, but I'm curious about like how have you cultivated a creative practice where you can keep coming back to the page, where you can absorb that discouragement? What does that look like for you? And is there any nugget of, not advice, but maybe insight for other people who are engaging in the sort of publishing sphere?
I wish I could say something very sage and wise here. I actually think a big part of it's just temperament, in the sense of, like, I have a short memory. So things that hurt, I often forget that I was hurt by them. Sometimes the pain stays, but the reason behind the pain doesn't. And so, like, I feel bad, but I don't remember why, which is super great. So, like, obviously I had a lot of failures on this road, like a lot of failures. I think I started writing, I think I wrote my first like novel when I was like just about 20 or so. So, and I think before I had a book that was good enough to really even go out to agents with, it was probably like my 10th or 11th book. I actually did do some publishing, like with a really tiny, teeny indie press that has long since folded, and it's under a different name. And so I'm like not supposed to talk about that. So we can just pretend I didn't say that. But I don't think it's like actually like a secret or anything. And so I think it's like, so part of it is just the fact that like, I don't have a choice when it comes to writing. And sometimes I wish I did. Like, I really think that if you are the kind of person who can go without it, like maybe you should, because as an industry, it is really, really difficult and kind of like soul crushing. Right. And it's very, it's scary. And you can write the most amazing book ever, win a ton of accolades, and then your next book comes out and it's a huge flop, right? There's no guarantees. And your work doesn't necessarily transfer. Like I don't know how to say this, but you can't like gain anything that can't be taken away, basically, except for the writing itself. So, you know, I kind of like realized that maybe I'm kind of glad that there was so much failure there, because it made me realize that like in the end, that all that there is just that morning hour or evening hour where I'm just sitting there by myself with my laptop, like trying yet again to get through like another first draft or cut an ungodly number of words from a draft that's too long. And like that's the whole of it. That's the crux of it. Everything else is periphery. The publishing deal, the agent, getting published in this magazine or this anthology, or like meeting this person, going to this conference. It's all just periphery to like the writing process itself. And I think that's the only way you can survive. I write because I have to. I write because it's what makes me, like, it levels me out. It makes me feel good. It helps me understand my world. I don't have the greatest, I think, metacognition. And it's like one way of working through problems and kind of righting wrongs and all of that stuff. Like that is the part that I need. If you are going through this and just hoping, really, you know, hoping for that publishing deal, and that's the only thing that's going to make you happy, like it's not going to make you happy. I don't think I answered the question, but I did my best.
No, you did. You did, because I think that's, you hit the nail on the head. So often as creatives, we're like, oh, if I do this thing, then I'm successful.
Yeah.
If I do this thing, then I'll be happy. And listen, if there are people out there living that life, wow. Yeah. That must be nice. I am not one of those people. Every accolade, every good thing in my world, my partner has to sit down and remind me, oh, wait, good news came last month. Yeah. You only think it came this month, but there was good news. And it's okay to get like it sporadically.
Yeah.
It's just, it's interesting though, because I think I'm really moved by the concept of like all there is the writing.
Yeah.
Like if that doesn't. And I don't think joy is the right word. Maybe fulfillment.
Yes.
I don't even know what the right word is for it, because sometimes when I'm writing, ooh, I'm like, ooh, look at these sexy words in this order that, ooh, oh my God, everyone's going to just pass out when they read this sentence. And then sometimes I'm like, I hate it. I hate this word. I hate that word. These are all just really bad words. Is this even English? Like, I don't even know. You know what? I'll edit it later. But that still feels like my purpose, I guess I would say. So I don't know. I think that's a really important piece, because it's easy to be on Twitter, any of the social media apps really, and just see everyone's, you know, their announcements that this is published and that's being published and I got this. And it's like, oh, look how easy and beautiful their life is. And it's like, no, there's decades typically of hustle behind that. There's decades of craft and hard work and disappointment behind that. I mean, you heard it in the Carmen Maria Machado episode.
Yes.
She didn't get a freaking agent coming out of the Iowa Writers' Workshop because she was writing short stories. And it's Carmen Maria Machado. You know what I mean?
I have like an altar to CMM in my house. Like I'm with you. Okay. Like I do.
Yeah. I mean, why not?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think it's really honest. And that's what I really appreciate in the, 20 minutes so far. You've been so real. And I personally really appreciate that, because I think it's easy to paint, especially in the era of TikTok, which I know you love.
I do love TikTok.
Easy to paint your life as like, oh, wow, look at the magic of I'm posing with a book in my study and look at the, oh, I'm this and everything's perfect and great and amazing. And it's like, no, it's the highs and the lows. Like, they're all there.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think it makes it a better world when we share those with each other. Like, I'm a better person when I can text you, when I can text Sarah, when I can text Monica and be like, I fucked up. Ah, fuck. And my friends be like, yeah, back on the horse, you know, when you're done crying, get back at it, you know? And it's like, okay, that's a good life.
I totally agree with you. And I think that one of the most toxic things that, like, social media writing culture, I guess is what I'll call it, like, you know, the writing Twitter and writing TikTok and everything, it's the fact that, like, it is a form of advertising. And so, you know, there's this fear that if you're honest about the setbacks that you're experiencing, one of two things is going to happen. One is that it's actually going to impact your writing career in some negative way, because if you're telling people, like, oh, I had a bunch of books fail before, you know, my debut published or whatever, you're afraid that, like, other agents or editors or writers will see that and, you know, decide that there's something wrong with you or your work, right? And that's really scary, particularly, like, I'm a little bit older than a lot of the writers that I see that are really, like, you know, active in that social media space, probably because, like, people my age just do social media less generally. And so, you know, I do have the benefit of, like, having done this for long enough and known enough people to know that, like, it doesn't mean anything, right? Like, a failure now doesn't mean anything. I've had some of my, like, biggest failures and then the next day gotten some of my biggest successes. So I think that's one of the two things that happens. And the other thing that happens is, like, if you are negative, quote unquote negative, because there's this, like, constant, like, positivity push on social media, then people will kind of come after you, right? Like, you're a complainer or you're like too sad. It's like you have to kind of hit the exact right amount of, like, struggle expression in your social media, because it's a form of advertising and, like, this parasocial expression of who you're supposed to be or whatever, your author persona. So it's horrible, which is, like, why I always get really excited about social media and, like, start every time I find a new one, I start on it. And then after a while, it's just so much work and it's really draining. And then I just kind of, like, fall off of it. So you'll see me on Twitter, like, I'll do, like, 50 tweets in a week because I'm, like, ready. And then, like, you'll see nothing for, like, 6 months, for example.
And yeah, I'm the same way. And social media does not reward that.
No, it doesn't.
It's like, you lost followers. I'm like, ah, but I had nothing to say. Should I have just been tweeting garbage? And it's like, yes, in fact, you should have.
That's what I do.
No, you tweet shit takes, but they're not garbage.
I love
they're
Sarah's
hilarious.
Twitter. Yeah. It's really, really funny.
I agree.
Follow me, everybody.
Everyone follow me to Twitter.
Very weird, actually, I guess, if you, like, listen to the podcast and you're not on my Twitter, because it's like this all the time, these takes.
I love it.
Get in on these takes. I sound like I'm 109 every time I talk about social media.
You really do. And I love that.
That's the charm, though. Like, that's part of the charm. It feels authentic.
Yeah, I know. It does. It's like stresses me out somewhat, but there's people who get, like, very, very stressed on and then they don't get off of social media. So anyway,
sorry, <I'm laughs>
we're all I think
it just
that's
hit,
the pause.
I love it that just pause. Hit us all real hard. You know, I was like, yeah, social media stress. And we all just kind of, like, clammed up for a second and just basked in how stressful it was. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do it on a regular basis. I'm constantly texting Sarah being like, I quit social media, and then I'm back on it like 2 weeks later and I'm like, I'm back on social media, because that's just
I'm
that's
like
me.
Essie, somebody DM'd me and it was like weird and I hated it so much, and then I'll like talk about it for like 90 minutes.
You get weird DMs.
I get weird DMs. I really do. I'm like smiling
weird.
So big right now.
We get very different flavors of weird DMs.
That's right. Yeah.
Genre blending may have been like what you're referring to or what you said.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, genre defying. And I'm like, oh, is that helpful? I don't know. And I've been thinking a lot about how you wrote three books in this book. We only get excerpts from two of them, right? And
I'm
one of them
so
we get the
extra.
Whole book.
Oh my God. Like, I'm telling you right now, this manuscript that my agent is sitting on is like, It's like there's a full ass like epistolary section before every single chapter. Like, I am so extra. I will cram. I'm like, well, I need a beginning to explain the beginning. Well, I need a beginning to explain that. Like, people are like, don't do prologues. And meanwhile, I'm like, okay, I'm going to make a prologue and not put the word prologue on it. That's one prologue. And then I'll do another prologue, but it's an excerpt. So that's not a prologue. Now I can do
Doesn't
my prologue.
Count.
Now I have my introduction. Like, I'm so extra. I can't help myself.
So for listeners who haven't read the book yet, because this is coming out just a couple days before the book publishes.
Ooh.
So the one of the books is Liar, Dreamer, Thief, the book, right? Then there's Mihi and the Mirror Man, which is excerpted throughout.
Yeah.
And The Magical World of Geometry, which is also excerpted throughout. And Mihi and the Mirror Man and The Magical World of Geometry are massive tomes in the ethos, the magical thinking, the world building of the character, the main character, Katrina Kim.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, I just have to know the process. Like, how did you write these? Did you write them? Like, was it written in the order that I'm holding in my hand? Did you write the geometry section? Tell me everything. Go.
So, actually, so in the original, like, the version that sold to Grand Central, like, Katrina is pulling things out of this magical world, right? And there are references to this children's book, but they weren't the same. They weren't, like, one and the same. And one of the things that I think my editor struggled with, because my editor doesn't have, like, the same panoply of mental illnesses that I do, is kind of like understanding some of the parts of like the obsession, the compulsion, hallucinations, how that was all related together with magical thinking, like the number stuff. So she was like, is there a way to like kind of concretize some of this so that people who don't like kind of have those experiences can get a better understanding of this, like of these pieces? And I'll be honest, I really fought that for quite some time because I feel like mental illness, like, it's not logical. Like, if you can explain it in a way that's, like, perfectly logical, then you're probably not dealing with mental illness in a way, right? Like, the reason it's so distressing is because it is irrational, right? And so part of me, like, really did not want to, like, lay these things out in a rational way that was, like, easy to digest and easy to understand. And so there was a lot of back and forth where we were, like, you know, I would draft up something and then she would say, I like it. And then I would be like, not okay with it after I'd read it a few times. So then I would cut some things out and then send it back. And so like, there was a lot of back and forth trying to get those pieces particularly. So Katrina was always into stellations, which is like, they are shapes composed of 11 sides. And if you're interested in what those look like, I actually have some very excellent fan art up on my Twitter and Instagram that someone has made for me. My first fan art for a book, I died. And
it's so good too. Yes. It's like they put a ton of work into it.
Oh my God.
It's like, it's a mood. I'm into it.
And very post-secret, which is connected to the book in ways that I won't mention. And so the stellations and the concept of the shapes and everything was always there. But again, it was this process of like her saying like, you know, I would like this to be like a little bit more concrete and like explained. And so I kind of just started putting this like textbook in there in an effort to kind of, I don't know, just kind of make these pieces. I didn't want to explain them inside of the story itself. I felt like that would just, because like, you know, when you're having a mental illness episode, you're not sitting there going like, well, this is this symptom and this is how this feels. And this is this, like, it doesn't make sense, right, for the character. So I had to kind of pull them out of the narrative, but also kind of clump them together. So people were like, okay, I'm reading this like fantasy section. I know what to expect here, kind of. Does that make sense? It was a way of like making the book safer almost for people that don't have those experiences.
What I really appreciated about what you did with that is what you just said, which is, you didn't turn it into a translation for people who don't experience mental illness or neurodivergence.
Yeah, right? It was really very...
You fought that. You fought to keep the heart of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so cool because it means the book is still written for a mentally ill neurodivergent audience, which is not always, rarely I should say, it is rarely ever the case. And that is... That's so incredible. What a clever way, too. Because you and I were talking about this. I have a manuscript I've been working on for like 4 billion years.
I know the feeling.
And and I can't let it go. I just keep writing new drafts. You know what I mean? And I remember texting you when I was reading Liar, Dreamer, Thief. And I was like, you fixed my book. Like, you helped me fix my fucking book with like the way you handled this. And so I think it's both like, A, you should read Liar, Dreamer, Thief because like it fucking rules. But also, listeners should read it, especially if you're working on a novel where you have people who are neurodivergent or you're trying to tell a story that isn't served up on a silver platter for the maybe widest possible audience, we'll say. I was going to say a different version of that, and that was not what I wanted. I think you use those tools so well. And to me, what it does is what so many good fantasy books do, right? Where they give us a fully fleshed out world. There are books in this world you've never heard of. Of course you haven't heard of them because you don't live in this fantasy world.
Yeah.
And so you brought your like world building skills to bear too on this suspense in this way that makes it I, you know, to me, it doesn't feel super genre defying in like a way where I can't, you know, what's it even trying to do? For me, it's like very clear what's happening.
Yeah.
Maybe that's because I also share some of your identities.
Love it.
But like, it's, I don't know. It feels so real to me. Like I think about Meehee and the Mirror Man. I think about the book. I think about the narrative. I think about what it meant to Katrina, you know, and to me, I'm like, oh, if I saw it on a bookshelf, I would break a library window. That's an inside joke that you will get once you read the book. just to get my hands on it, I would do that, you know?
Yeah. But would it be there?
So, I don't know. I think it's really exciting the way that it's, you know, it's on the page, it's in between the lines of the page. You know, depending on your identity, it might feel really real and close. It might feel like something, okay, I'm trying to read a translation. But I don't know. I found it so rich and so textually rich is what I want to say because of the multiple sort of narratives inside the one narrative.
Yeah. And I was scared. I'll be totally honest. So like, obviously there were a lot of changes. And like I said, a process of trying to make things more concrete for people that don't experience these things. And there were things that I fought really, really hard for, just like dug my heels in, particularly like the intersection of like mental health and poverty was something that, you know, I've obviously lived through and thought a lot about. And so like there were sections like there, she talks a lot about her car, for example, because her car is falling apart. And I had all these discussions with my editor. And like, I guess like in the end of it, it's like, if you've ever been really, really poor in a place where you need a car and you've also had mental health issues, like you've spent a lot of time thinking about your car. And I didn't know how else to like explain that. It just had to stay. You know what I mean? So there are things that I just really dug my heels in about. And there were things that I was like, okay, well, I have to compromise. So like, I'm going to make these changes. And then I was really, really scared, right? And I'm finally starting to get some reader reviews, like the early reader reviews. And they've been so like deeply validating because I've had people say like, oh, I have OCD. And this is the first time I've seen it represented this well on the page. Or, you know, yeah, I know, right? Like I cried like a baby for like a long time.
I'm going to cry right now.
I know, right? And so like in the end, it doesn't even matter if the book does well or doesn't do well. Like, I guess for me, it's like if like one person who is not used to seeing themselves represented in narrative, in fiction, particularly in like, you know, mystery fiction, because like you always have like one of two protagonists, right? There's always like somebody who either has like a drug addiction, like substance abuse issue that isn't portrayed very realistically and doesn't actually affect their life very much. Or you have someone who's just like so abrasive that like nobody can get close to them except for their Watson, right? So so for a person like that, you know, maybe likes to consume that genre, but doesn't see themselves represented in it, to be able to see themselves represented in it, I think that was worth it. Like it was worth the whole thing. It was worth writing the book. It was worth editing the book. It was, you know, it made it worth it. I don't know how else to say that. So, but I was scared.
No, I mean, I think it's a dream to reach someone that way. And I cried because I'm just like, yeah, I'm so happy. Because that's how I felt reading it, honestly. Is I was like, I've never seen a motherfucker talk about how like my brain plays tricks on me.
Yeah.
You know, like, and it does. And yeah. Like in this way where I'm not a crazy person, and I intentionally am using that word because that is how I feel like people like me have been betrayed in books.
Yeah.
Betrayed and portrayed in books, you know, throughout history. And so it's magical to see someone who's like, it's not like Katrina's making good choices, y'all.
No. You know? Like, but I didn't make good choices.
Same, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's really funny, actually. So some of the readers that don't like the book talk about how she's just making these terrible choices everywhere. And I'm just like, look, like she's got a lot on her plate, like psychologically, family wise, monetarily. Like I when I was in similar situations, like I made some real, real terrible choices. Some of them probably that I'm very lucky to be like alive and relatively well at this point in time for. And
oh, certainly. I think that a lot about my choice.
Right? I'm like, whoo, survived that. Oh. Wow. Congratulations, B. So, yeah.
Yeah. Being poor in your 20s is the worst thing in the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, you do things that you're not quite so proud of sometimes.
Yes.
And you walk away and hope you don't do them again.
Just work.
Hope. But sometimes hope you don't do sometimes them again. It takes a while.
I'm just really grateful no one was recording. Because, like, when we were in our 20s, no one had social media.
Oh, yeah. I would have been
fucked. Yeah, I'm glad that TikTok didn't exist then.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Man. Oh, I don't even want to think about it.
I know, right? I'm like, oh, God.
No. I've been spared a terrible fate. I prefer not to contemplate. I didn't mean to rhyme, but I like it.
Good luck, Gen Z.
Yeah, good luck, y'all. They're like, we're not idiots. Oh, fine.
We are.
I don't agree. I am. I think everyone is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's actually really funny because, so Katrina's like pretty much like a self-insert for me. Like, I mean, like, obviously I'm not exactly like her, but a lot of her characteristics are, and a lot of her marginalizations are. And so, like, I have had a couple of reader reviews that are like, this person obviously assembled together like every possible marginalization, just stuck it like as a political statement. And I think that's just really funny because you know, I mean, I don't know. I just didn't want, like, I was like all burned out from writing all these books. And so I just kind of stuck very close to things I knew very close and personal. And so I think that's really, I don't know. I don't know where I was going with this. It was funny, but like, as I said it, it became less and less funny. And now I'm just sad. So like, I'm moving on.
Right. Yeah. We're going to fight this person. But yeah, I don't know. I was wondering about that a little bit because I was like, I can see some like self-insert, but that happens all of the time, yeah. Right? Like I'll do a little bit of self-insert in a story and that means that people act like it's like straight autobiography, yeah. Or something. And you're like,
Well, okay. And I have terrible boundaries. So if I am like deeply immersed in a character, like I'll start becoming more like that person. And then that person becomes more like, you know, it becomes like this cycle. Right. I have definitely experienced obsessions and compulsions, but I don't always, like, I don't have OCD. I have other mental illnesses that when I'm in a bad way, I'll start kind of going down into that like OCD space. And now that I definitely have been diagnosed with ADHD, it's extra complicated because there are intersections between OCD and ADHD. And it gets very difficult to like tease things apart. So, but because I was writing this book and I was having to spend so much time thinking about how it feels when you're having a compulsion or when you're obsessed with something or when you're hallucinating, like I started to have like way more of those symptoms in my day-to-day life. And so there was this point where I was like editing this book like 20 hours a day because I was like not sleeping, not eating, just trying to like edit it as quickly as I can so I can get it off of my desk because I could tell that I was like starting to deteriorate very, very quickly from like kind of staying in that material. And I knew there would be like, I just needed to like finish it because part of my brain was thinking like, as long as I'm like working on this draft, I'm like open to some terrible cosmic consequence that I don't know about. And so I just have to finish it so that, you know, that bad thing doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. That is some intense writing motivation.
It really is. I don't recommend it. I'm not going to do that again. I really don't. I was like, lesson learned. Don't do this again. So, yeah.
I was talking with a friend about that pretty recently, though, about how, like, when you're writing certain things, because I know I've heard this from, like, actors and stuff where it's like, ooh, that role, that was a weird time in my life or something. And I think maybe it's the same a little bit with writing where you're just, like, you're trying to put yourself in this mindset. Sometimes I'll write a draft and be like, oh, this isn't quite right. And it's because the person isn't going through enough hell, right? Like, you're just like, I need to make things like worse for them. And I need them to do some terrible things before we get out of this narrative.
Yeah.
Because you just kind of have to sometimes. But then it's just like, what kind of mindset would I have to be in order, like right now I'm just hanging out at my house with my pets or something. What kind of mindset would I have to be in? And then you just like really kind of can sink into it a little bit.
Yeah. So like you're saying I'm a method actor. I like that. I might start just saying that. It's better than my long-winded explanation. I'm just a method writer. I like it.
What am I going to do?
I'm sure that's a thing. I didn't invent that.
When I'm like trying to work out dialogue in particular, I do it out loud a lot where I'm like, how would they land these words because they're angry, because they're happy, because they're whatever. And for a podcast Sarah and I are working on, I was like, okay, I need to hear this because I need to make sure that it'll sound good on audio. And so I like delivered the line the way that I would like want it to be delivered by an actor. And my pets all ran from my room. I was like, okay, I am getting intense.
It's like a stampede.
They're like,
no, actually, I love that. I read everything out loud, not usually in the first draft, because at that point, like none of the words are going to stay. So it's like pointless. But once I'm in like the honing and sharpening stages, like, because I need the sound of everything. And it's really funny because like, I think this is part of the obsession compulsion piece. Like certain sounds have to be balanced, for example. So like, you know, we went back and forth about different like word choices or whatever. But like, I was very adamant that Meehy and the Mirror Man works because it's balanced in terms of the syllables and the mirrored names and all of that stuff. So dialogue, yes, but also like, I just, everything has to sound good or I don't like it, which is why I'm really struggling right now. I'm trying to cut this fairly large draft down by about 10-20% so that it's kind of more closer to like what, you know, industry guidelines for that genre are. And I'm really struggling because I chose all the words in it based on the sound and the rhythm. And now I have to like, you know, cut out as many words as possible and make the sentences very succinct. And it's like driving me absolutely bonkers.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about that because that's something that I think people don't, I don't know, not everybody thinks of it, even just as a reader, right?
Yeah.
Like you have an idea of a rhythm in your head whenever you're reading it, kind of.
Yeah.
Everything's in your own voice, but it's, you know, you kind of play around with it, I think, or like the way that things are spelled out, it'll help you kind of have this idea of how things are supposed to sound. So I think that there is this kind of interesting way of there being sound in stories anyway. And I always think that there's something kind of neat about that.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. But I definitely think that like part of that for me comes from doing short fiction, because short fiction, so I have done some short fiction, as you may know. And sorry, that's probably not funny to the listener because they don't know about the conversation we had before this started. Yeah, I think with short fiction, because it's often more artistic, right? Like you're often pushing the envelope a little more in terms of like voice and style. You're trying things that like maybe, you know, like a very stylized prose style, for example, you wouldn't want to do like for 95,000 words, right? But in a short piece, you can. And so I think that like part of my like obsession about sound actually comes from writing so many short stories, and because I do read those out loud like very, very obsessively. I want them almost like, some of them are, like are poetic. Actually, one of them I wrote and it turned out it was like actually a poem because I sent it and they were like, no, this is a poem. And then, so then I sent it to Fantasy as a poem and they were like, yeah, it's a poem. They published it. And I was like, oh, that's surprising. You know, so like, yeah, I guess, yes, I agree with you.
Neat. I also think that I was wanting to talk to you a little bit about all of the short stories that you've written, because you have written a ton of short stories. I was curious, was that your first thing of writing that you started doing? Was it short stories and then you started doing novels, or how did that all work out?
Also, yes. Who published your first short story?
You know, it was it was this really amazing venue. I don't know if you're familiar with queer science fiction fantasy venues. But there's this anthology called Decoded Anthology. And
Sarah, you knew, right? First. That was acting. Okay, just checking. I was like, we talked about this, right? Sarah's like,
we talked about this actually whenever we were on our last call, which was actually like a little bit too long ago, honestly. But I remember being like, what? Are you serious? The deck? What?
Yeah. So that was my very first short sale. And I still really like that story. Sometimes I go back and I read it because
it's so good.
It's different than a lot of the stories I've written. It's a little bit more, I want to say like literary almost. Like it's very contemporary and kind of more like absorbed in sound and things like that. And it's like a quieter, like a slower kind of story. But I still really love it. And like it's based on something that actually happened to my house. So I often think of it when I look at my house, which is often because I live in my house. So occupying a lot of brain area.
I remember it was like, oh, that's neat. And then I think the next time I saw you, it's like you see, you know, the people who you know and who you've worked with before out in the wild, kind of. Like I saw that Nightmare Magazine had published one of your stories.
Yeah.
And I was just like, what? So as soon as I saw it, I got so excited. And I listened to the podcast version of it they had.
And the voice actor was so good. I think her name was Gabriella. Just amazing.
I agree.
Yes.
Yeah, that was awesome. And it was basically just, you know, from there, you've been published now in a whole bunch of amazing places. So I'm excited. I was reading a little bit of it even earlier today and was just like, psh, Maria.
Aw, that's amazing. Yeah, I actually wrote almost all of those stories at the same time. Like I had just turned something into my agent or something like that. And I just did not want to deal with another book. And so I just like, but like, you know, if you write novels and you're like, I don't know, like you're trying to like publish and everything, like sometimes you wind up writing a lot, right? Because you know, they're really long and you have to revise them. And so I was kind of like in the practice of like producing like every single day. And so so then I just turned that to short stories and I wrote like I think like 140,000 words of short stories. And then I was like, what do I do with all these? And so I just started sending them And I'm still selling stories from that batch. Like, I have written a couple more since then, like, but I think that the pace of short story writing has slowed down because as the novel stuff has, you know, been doing better and, like, you know, I mean, like, I had to do edits and things like that with my editor. Like, there's not as much time, unfortunately, for short fiction.
Yeah, for sure. And it's like it is this matter of, like, you know, you only have to place a book like one time. But yeah. With a short story, you might have to send it and send it and send it. And of course, that's like a market that's always changing. It doesn't pay super great for the most part.
Yeah.
That's the same with me. Like, short stories have really gotten put on the back burner for me somewhat over the last, like, year. And I'm like, the other day I was like, oh, no, like, this whole year is going to go and I won't have written a new short story.
Oh, my God. Don't say that out loud. Because, like, that's like, I think about that all the time and start freaking out, like, total FOMO, right? Yeah. I'm like, oh, my God, no one's going to know who I am because I haven't written anything and published it this year.
Right. For me, it was just like, you love doing this and, like, you don't have the time to, you know? And so I was just like, oh, it's cool. I only have like 17 other things going on. I'll be able to just fit these like three short stories that I had sudden ideas for in the middle of everything. So, but by the end of it, you'll get to this place of just being like, okay, cool. I'm so sick of that. And now I'm going to go back to like the other things I was working on.
Yes, definitely.
It's nice to have those breaks though, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're writing fiction that's so much longer than anything I've ever written personally. So I always am just like, yeah, no kidding. Like, I'm sure taking like a short story break is amazing.
Oh, especially because, like, you just, like I said, you get to do things that like are more experimental, like really push yourself. I really like taking short story prompts, like, you know, like when people do sub calls.
Oh, that's neat, right? Yeah. I love doing that too.
But like doing them the weirdest way possible.
Yeah.
I like writing for the Bane Prize because they're, first of all, I don't know that I would want to get published for the Bane Prize. But like also they would not publish anything I do. Like, I am definitely not their brand. So I like doing their prompts because like I have to really work to like reinvent them. You know what I mean?
It's a very like low pressure situation. You're just like, you know what? I'm not in on this, but I'm going to do this for my own pleasure. And yeah, for sure. Sometimes it's just fun. And sometimes it just kind of keeps you in the game, right? Yes. And like the way that you need to, you're just like, okay, cool. I'm going to write this weird ass story.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I have, you know, what 100,000 words do for something. Like, yes, yes, yes. But I could always take a break.
Yeah.
And remember what I love about writing.
Yes. Yeah. And sometimes I really need that. Like, really, really need
it. Oh, God. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think everybody does, right? Where it's just like, take a breather.
Yeah.
I have like really good stamina of sitting down and just writing and writing and writing. And because my job necessitates it, I'm constantly writing. And even still, there will be times where I'm like, wow, you haven't talked to a person in days. Maybe you should go outside. Even if not to talk to a person, you could just go for a walk.
Yes. And working from home, you really have to. Yes, I definitely feel that. God. I actually had to do that today. I was like, because I am a developer for my day job. So I work on a computer at home. And at some point I was just like, I realized I was like humming to myself and I was like, oh, I should probably go outside now. Like, you know,
that's, I think too, like the deck, honestly, like not to just like revisit the one that we published the most, because all of your short stories that I've read have been really amazing.
Oh my God, but thank you.
I love the deck because it has that feeling of like, I work from home. That's basically like the whole horror of it is like, I work from home in a town where maybe you don't always invite your neighbors over, right?
Yes. Like, yep. And I've been looking at my window treatments a little too much. Yeah, definitely.
Yes. That's the best part of it all.
And that was a true story. So. I could even take a picture of these curtains.
Oh my
and
God.
Send them
please
to you.
Do. I really do want to see them. I've thought about those curtains a lot. Yeah, and so for listeners, what's really exciting is just last month we adapted the deck to audio. Woo-hoo, and so woo-hoo. You can listen to it now and we will drop it in the show notes so you can go check that out. That's so exciting.
I'm so excited. My favorite thing when it comes to short fiction is when a magazine makes an audio of that story. I always hear it, things that I never even imagined would be in there, and I love it, the interpretations. It's just amazing.
Oh, I love it too. Yeah, I had one of my stories done by the No Sleep podcast, and I didn't expect them to do any of the things that they did. I was like, oh, clearly, because this is like a sound-based story, it's going to do this. And I was like, oh, they didn't do that. Wow, they're so good. Like, yeah. Oh, they just did something else entirely. That's amazing. And then, like, it's some of my favorite voice actors on the show did it, which made me be really happy because I was just like, oh, wow.
Oh, my gosh.
I didn't expect the people who I listen to all the time to be the ones doing this.
Amazing.
But it was.
That's how I feel right now, though, right? Because I've listened. Like, it's so funny because, like, so sometimes, like, I'll be listening to your podcast and then I'll start talking to you, like, as if you're there. I'll be like, I see, oh, my God. And then I'll be like, oh, they can't hear me, can they? Like, they're not here right now. So I've listened to, like, so many hours of your voices while I'm showering, while I'm eating, in my, like, work from home environment, while looking at my curtains. And now to be like on this podcast, I feel super famous, but also like it's a very out of body weird experience, right? It's like my world within my world now. Oh my God, I'm going to listen to myself. This is weird. Okay.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, that's true. You will. It's going to be a surprise to you, maybe. Like, it'll just pop up on your feed one day and you're just like, wait a second, that name looks familiar.
Who's that? Did I do this? I'll call Justin. Oh, that's his job. I'm like, what is this? He's like, yeah, you did that last year. Okay, thank you.
That's love. That's love right there.
Yep. Yep.
You are a person. What? I forgot. I thought I was just a typing machine.
Yeah, I actually injured myself typing too much. So definitely. Yep.
I need to heed this warning. I'm like, I'm listening up right now.
You sat up in the chair. I gave myself a tailbone injury. I sat in one place like too long without moving. And like, I tend to ADHD, I tend to hyper-focus when I'm into something. And I probably didn't move for like 6 or 8 hours. And I like bruised it. And then I like shifted some ligament. And it, like, yeah, it's like this like semi-permanent. I actually have to see a physical therapist about it next week, I think. Maybe. I don't know what day it is, but like sometime soon. Yeah. And that's not the first time I've injured myself writing.
Oh, my goodness. So. I will write in like a weird position and not realize I'm doing it because I'm hyper focusing too. And like, I'll be like, oh, my God, I can't move my shoulder. Like, I've completely locked it up because it was hurting the whole time, but I couldn't realize it because I was so in what I was doing. Ugh. Self.
I won't get out of bed to write sometimes. I just like lay in bed for like 8 hours.
You got, I'm an occupational therapist. Like, you're killing me, right? Like, I mean, I don't practice anymore, but I used to be one, right? I'm still licensed, I think, in this state. And like this postural stuff, you're giving me palpitations. I'm telling you, lying in bed writing.
Like, we're gonna like open our emails tomorrow, and you're like, so here's what I recommend.
No, I'm gonna be like, this isn't medical advice, but.
But here's 14 articles I need you to read immediately.
Exercise plan.
It's called literally like basic information your silly ass knows you're not supposed to be doing this.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah. Oh.
Meanwhile, I injured my own tailbone and also like injured one of the nerves in my leg. So like I can't say anything. I'm like just as bad. I just have the knowledge that I should not be doing this in a very deep way, but I still do it.
So, okay, this is a perfect segue because one of the things I wanted to ask about is, well, A, I will share with listeners, Maria, you've been a very big part of me coming to terms with my own neurodivergence.
Woohoo!
Because you're very loving, but you'll be, okay, honestly, this was the moment I was like, I can no longer live in denial. You were like, I love your podcast because it's so relaxing to listen to someone with ADHD interview people.
I thought this was common knowledge. Just to be clear, like I thought that was part of the thing. I didn't know.
Weren't like, yeah, you weren't calling me out. It was like a very like, oh, this is all information we share. And so I was like, oh man, everybody keeps telling me like all of the signs are clear. I am neurodivergent. So it's been actually incredible sort of grappling with that. And I think I actually, you know, to be fair, I honestly had figured it out earlier and you were just like so matter of fact that it just like, you know, when it just cuts right through the bullshit where you're like, you know what? When you're right, Maria. When you're right,
but I thought we had talked about this and I just forgot. Like, you know, that's what I thought. I thought I had just forgotten when you told me, just to be clear. Because I do that a lot, right? So
yeah, that is true.
I just assumed.
That is true. So, you know, I'm curious for you, like being neurodivergent and a creative, like how do you manage that? Like, are there... Do you have, you know, tips and tricks? Do you lean into your hyper focus? I mean, I think you've sort of told us a little bit of that, but I'd love to just hear more about how do you...
in an unhealthy way? Yes. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Hey, it's okay. For everything, there is a season.
It's like, oh, good. This is my crazy season. Great. Perfect. My partner knows because he comes home and he's like, whoops, she's doing the thing. I'm going to go make dinner. Goodbye.
Again, that's love. But you know, like, mm-hmm. I'm just curious about, I think there's like a lot of the advice out there about being creative or writing or all those things. They're just antithetical to being neurodivergent. And yeah. Like,
even though all of us are, right?
Right. Like, which is so funny. Right. But like, you know, write every day. That is just, that's not helpful advice for me ever. There's nothing mm-hmm. on this planet I can do every day. There just isn't. Like, drink water? Nope. There are days I don't. I
can't believe you didn't know you had ADHD.
Right. Like,
you're like, my kryptonite is a routine. I'm like,
you're like, and that makes me think. But you know, I'm just curious for you, like, how have you, you know, it doesn't have to be all good shit, but like, how have you grappled yeah. with what it means to be neurodivergent and how have you, you know, kept going, I guess I would ask.
Yeah. I didn't know for the longest time. I just assumed that I was bad at things. And that other people like were doing these things well and also struggling as much as I was struggling. But they just somehow managed to keep doing it even though they were struggling. Right. So like, I don't think I found out until, maybe like 2 years ago, people were telling me like, you have ADHD. And it was really funny because I'm a licensed occupational therapist. And a big part of that is studying like neurodevelopmental growth, particularly in children. So when you're talking about like ADHD and autism and like the symptoms and signs and da 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 da. Like, I'm supposed to know all that stuff. And I do. Like, I pass my board exam and all that stuff. I've worked with those populations in children and in adults. And yet, for some reason, my brain was not kind of making that connection, right? And then I think like 2 years ago, I have a friend and he was like, Maria, like, you have ADHD. Like, go talk to somebody. You have ADHD. And I just was like, I don't believe you. But then I went and talked to somebody. And it was really funny because, like, you know, first they do a bunch of like neuropsychological testing with like pen and paper. And I love taking tests, right? I'm very, very good at taking tests. I have tons of compensatory mechanisms for test taking and like memory and stuff because I have a terrible memory. So like, if you show me a bunch of images, like in 3 seconds, I've seen the image and I've made up an entire like story with like a fantasy land and everything about this like duck on top of a toaster or whatever. So that like 10 minutes later, when you're like, where's the duck? I'm like, on the toaster, obviously. Right. So at first this guy was like, no, you don't have ADHD. You're great. And he's like, but we also have to do this other like social component. So then he asked me a bunch of questions about my life. And then he interviewed my partner, Justin, my husband. And then he was like, you definitely have ADHD. Like, it's really, really like, you know, it's noticeable. Right. Like, I lose things constantly. I really struggle with routines. I have like no memory whatsoever, no working memory because I'm not paying attention. If you don't pay attention, you can't make new memories. Right. Attention is a key component to memory formation. And like, I have the insomnia piece of it, which is really, really common. I have like the eating piece of it, which is unfortunate, but common. Like, so it's just like I have most of the pieces. It's super fun. And I think finding that out and then kind of like looking at what the research says, particularly for AFAB people and queer people, because, you know, the presentation is a little bit different. And part of that is like the social roles and expectations. And part of that's probably like, I don't know, hormones or whatever. Like, we don't actually know a lot. It really was like a reckoning for me because, you know, I had just kind of chalked up all of the struggles that I've had, like, particularly with like work and being productive, to like a combination of like, I'm really lazy and also like I'm mentally ill. And so I just figured that, like, you know, I was broken essentially, right? And it wasn't this question of like, your brain just works really differently and you have to work around that. Being an occupational therapist was terrible for me. I was a very good OT. I had very good results with patients. Patients really liked me. I knew my material really well, obviously good empathy, blah, blah, blah. But it's a very time-based profession. You have to know to the minute what you're doing with a patient at all times. And I am completely time blind. I had this tested and they were like, it's really bad. Like, I actually don't know. If you just like find me at like when I'm working and you're like, what time is it? I am usually within 6 hours, which is like not a very good, like, most people can tell you if it's morning or night or noon or whatever. I have no idea. So it was not a good fit for me. And I really struggled and I felt a lot of stress because of it. And, you know, I almost had like a complete breakdown because I was really particularly struggling with that piece, that time management piece. So the pandemic was really interesting because I got COVID right at the beginning of the pandemic. And then I was super, super sick for like, I think 7 months. I was unable to speak. I had a horrible cough. I had like no energy. And I wasn't able to go back to being an OT. And I also like couldn't go back because I developed this like really strong irrational fear of hospitals, which is not great when you work in a hospital. But like, that's what happened with my brain. And so like, I started looking for like different careers and stuff like that and wound up kind of like stumbling into web development. I have a friend who's a developer who's been telling me for years that I should learn it, who also I think maybe has ADHD. And so like, it kind of like, I don't know. I was like, well, her brain's doing really well on this. Like, maybe I should try it. And I love it. And I also don't have a lot of those constraints that I used to have in terms of like time management and things like that. And it's created a lot more mental room to do things like write. So my writing career has like really exploded as a result of like kind of understanding this part of my brain better and then being able to like manage these different pieces. I don't think I answered your question, but I kind of answered your question, maybe.
No, I think you did. It's interesting to me because something I think about a lot, and you know, this is when I was still in my denial. I'll tell you, like, oh my God, it's like the same thing people say when they're trans, but they don't know it yet, where they're like, I'm just a great ally, you know, like I'm just out here like for the trans people, and then they're like, oh fuck, I'm trans, God damn it, you know, like I already knew I was bi, and now this, which is always funny, but it was kind of similar. I was like, I'm just like a good ally because my partner has ADHD, and so I was like, you know, I read about ADHD a lot. I think about ADHD a lot, like, and I was like, wow, I, you know, found someone who was like, you know, I actually don't try and make myself focus. I let myself be really into something. And I've learned a lot of cool skills from that. And that's been really good for my life. Obviously, maybe not obviously, this person came from a lot of place of privilege. So doesn't have, you know, what everybody with ADHD does have in terms of expectations on their lives. But
sure,
I heard that and I was like, you know what? What would it be like if I let myself become a little bit obsessed with something? And I did it with a book, with writing a book. And it was the fastest I've ever written a book because I just let myself not do other things. And again, it was from a place of privilege. I have work that is very flexible. Sarah was very chill about the podcast and very cool about it. It was like, it's cool. It got up today. Who cares what time? You know, and it was kind of magical. It was also very exhausting. It was like, I was telling Izzy Wasserstein about this. I was like, you know, it was both like being possessed by the book. It was like, I wasn't even me anymore in some ways.
Yeah, definitely.
It was kind of amazing because I didn't have to do that over 6 months. You know, I just had really, for me, it was 13. It was a middle grade novel, so only 55,000 words, but it was 13 days. And I just banged out a draft. And I say that because I think that so often when we think of neurodivergence, it can feel so limiting. It can feel so much like, oh, I can't be like everyone else. I can't function the way they do. And yes, there's so much grief and it's important to let yourself feel those things. And I have a ton of grief around, oh, like, why can't I just function like everyone else? Why can't I just do the things I don't want to do? But I'm also, I'm trying to also hold the other pieces, right? That like you were saying, like, I can work with my brain. I can help my brain do what I feel very engaged in, which is telling stories. And, you know, the podcast is one of the ways I can do that because, like, I get super into every interview. You know, I'm like, oh, I read 15 articles about you. You know, people are like, that's really intense. And I'm like, yeah. And then I, like, just completely forget it because I don't have to actually remember it, you know? It exists. Yeah. I can go listen to it. So I don't know. I think there's something magical in the – in the not just engaging in self-flagellation, not just beating the shit out of ourselves for being who we are, but actually loving and accepting that and seeing that there are some parts that can be, I don't know if the word is good, but they can be used for our advantage. They can help us with what our goals are. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Curious how you feel.
Working with your brain, I agree with you, generally speaking. I think that, you know, one of the great things, so I'm also like you, where I was like, oh, I'm just a good ally because my husband, we figured out maybe like a year into our marriage, we've been married like, I don't know, like 6 years, 7 years, you'd have to ask him, he's the number keeper. that he was autistic. And the way we figured this out is because, like, one day I realized he just, like, doesn't ever look me in the eyes. And I was just like, is there a reason that you don't look at me in the eyes? And he was like, well, eye contact's really painful. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And of course, being an OT, like, my wheel started turning, so that I came back the next day and I asked him a bunch of questions. And it turns out, like, he's completely face blind and he has, like, this map inside of his head where he, like, keeps all of the emotions. And when he sees someone make a face, he, like, matches it to his face map to try to figure out, like, what emotion they're making, right? Like, are they happy or sad? Because he doesn't have that, like, intrinsic machinery of just, like, looking at someone and knowing how they feel. So that kind of started us down this little journey. And then one day he came to me and he's like, I think I'm autistic. And I was like, yeah, that's probably true. And so, you know, I was like, oh, well, you know, we work out really well together and, you know, I'm a good ally and, like, whatever. And then, like, you know, of course, 6 years later, it's like, actually, you also had ADHD this whole time. And I think he knew before I knew, right? But he didn't, he wasn't sure because, you know, with autism, he's, like, not sure socially, like, maybe everyone's just like this and my wife's, like, a little bit louder or whatever. But yeah, working with your brain. Sorry, we were talking about that. I got distracted again. That's, like, how I operate. I agree with you 100%. I think that one of the things that my marriage has taught me is that, you know, we both have, like, a lot of gifts to offer. Like, a lot of people with ADHD, like, we can't do the executive functioning of, like, mailing a letter. Impossible. But if the zombie apocalypse was to happen right now and we had to commandeer, like, a 15-person task chain to do, like, I don't know, get food and water and, like, all this stuff, like, surprisingly, I think we would do really, really well. I have been really shocked by my ability to manage incredibly chaotic situations when I can't manage very, very basic, normal routine situations. I have to take a pill every day and, like, a vitamin, and I can't seem to manage to do it. Like, we have tried everything, post-it notes, reminders. I have alarms going off all over the house. I've taped the pill up into eyeline. I've put it inside of my glasses before. Like, it's just, for some reason, like, routine's not going to happen. But when something really big happens in the house, like the roof is leaking or, like, whatever, like, I just somehow shift into gear and I'm able to, like, manage, like, a lot of information at once, whereas, like, he's very, very stressed out by that. But he's able to do all of his routines, like, perfectly. In fact, he's very, very insistent about doing them, like, the right way. So I agree with you. I think that, like, our brains do have very unique gifts to offer. I saw some research recently that indicates that it may be a higher than average proportion of people who were, like, the original explorers to different countries and stuff probably had ADHD, were very big on novelty seeking and curiosity. I think it definitely finds its way into my work. Like, when I look at this book now, I'm like, oh, well, obviously I had ADHD. I should just read my own book. I would have known, you know, what I mean? Because it's like, look at all these connections between all of these, like, disparate things that, like, aren't even possibly connected, right? Like, I'm just like, this bridge and this thing and this thing and this thing, and these are all connected, but also this is connected. Like, it's so obvious, like, in the fabric of my work. I don't know why I didn't realize it before. And kind of like what you were saying about privilege, I think a big theme that I've noticed looking back at my body of work now, like, that I have, like, the time, is, like, kind of the interaction of, like, these different circumstances, this brain configuration, and, like, not having privilege, right? That's a huge theme in Liar, Dreamer, Thief. I forgot the title of my book for a second. Did you see that I was, like, in?
The pause was just, like, a half second longer than normal.
It felt really long. Like, I ran through a whole, like, jingle in that pause. But, like, you know, Katrina's really, like, if she had, like, more money, like, if she had a good job and more money, like, the whole book wouldn't have happened, right? Mm-hmm. It, like, everything hinges around that lack of, like, that particular set of privileges. And if she had, like, a family that was a little different, that wouldn't have happened, and, like, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, like, I don't know, like, it's the linchpin of everything, right? I don't know where I'm going with this, but I guess my point is, I wholly agree with you. As a writer, you have amazing gifts to offer, you know, if you want to tap into your neurodivergence. You don't have to, though. Like, you do what you want to do, mm-hmm. right? We live long lives, do what you got to do to be happy and, like, enjoy this.
Hey, everybody. Earlier today, I made myself a sandwich, and I thought to myself, if I could rate and review this sandwich, I would give it 5 stars. And I would say, this sandwich is so incredible, is best sandwich I've had literally in days. And it was everything I wanted it to be. And that would be a positive review that would help me see what audience responses were to my sandwich. And, you know, it would just be really a helpful system. I wonder if there's another situation where rating and reviewing would come in handy. Oh,
huh.
Oh my God. No, what? You could rate and review this podcast, and then that helps us find our audience, and it helps us find whatever we've lost. It helps us find what we've lost.
Helps us find our socks, our keys, our cell phone. People don't talk about it enough. When you rate and review, it really changes someone's life.
Yeah, it's going to change my life, that's for sure. And we like to read the reviews, you know, the ones that are positive, that say soothing and nice things.
5 stars. We'll give you 5 stars as a listener. You give us 5 stars as a podcast.
5 sandwiches. This podcast, let's face it, is 5 delicious sandwiches.
So we're talking about privilege and what role that plays in Katrina's life and in how the narrative is really about these areas where she lacks privilege. And I just keep thinking, you know, there's 2 things we haven't talked about that I just want to hear you talk about a little bit. So one of the things is Katrina's lesbian, and one of the things is that she's Korean American. And those are huge pieces of who she is. And they're, I would say they're on the page differently than, like, I wouldn't pitch this book to someone as about like a Korean American lesbian, even though it is about a Korean American lesbian, because those pieces are just so, they're not what's preoccupying her time, right? Her mental illness, her neurodivergence, those are really preoccupying her because of her obsessions. But they're still huge pieces of who she is. And they make the book what it is. So I guess I wanted to talk about, you know, you talked a little bit about that a-hole who was like, this person just made up a bunch of identities. And you're like, that's literally me, so fuck you. You know, like, it isn't about making up those identities. It's about exploring what happens when this person is all those things, because human beings are all those things, because we're all really fucking complex. But we like to treat only one group of people like they're complex. Wonder why. Fucked up reasons.
Yeah.
But I'm curious for you, when you think about Katrina being a lesbian, Katrina being Korean American, like, how does that interact with her mental illness and her neurodivergence? Why is that so integral to her story? It's weird to ask about, like, the identities of the characters, why they're integral, but I really just want an excuse for you to talk about gay shit and Korean shit, okay?
Oh my God, I love talking about gay shit and Korean shit. So this is part, you should just said, when you talk about gay shit and Korean shit,
you know what? Like, cut the whole question, Kate. We're just going to say, Maria, tell me everything about gay shit and Korean shit. Go.
Okay. Yeah. Korean shit. Let's start with Korean shit. I think that, like, one of the nice things about having such a long road to publication and so many, like, books that didn't make it, is that I got out all of the books that people usually start with, where you kind of, like, mimic what you've read without critically thinking about, like, who you want to represent, right? So this question of, like, representation. In fact, I don't think I was really thinking about representation until I went to grad school. So I went to grad school for occupational therapy, and it was quite late, I think. I was, like, second oldest person in the class. And it was like a 50-person class, and it's a really weird occupational therapy school, because you have, like, a cohort of 50 people, and then you're just with them 24/7, 365. Like, every single class is, you go to all the same classes at the same time. Like, it's just, it's the most, it's like being a camp or something, you know what I mean? And I realized very, very quickly that I really did not fit into this environment, right? Like, I was way poorer than the majority of people. I was the only person that was actively identifying as a queer person, and one of, like, only, like, 2 or 3 people that was married, which was really kind of funny. And I think I was the only person that actively, you know, said that they were disabled. I obviously, a class of 50 people, there've got to be, like, some more disabled people, but, like, you know, not everyone feels comfortable sharing. And I think that, like, I started to get very angry. So over the course of, like, 2 years, I'm in grad school, I'm paying, like, just a god awful amount of money and just, like, mortgaging my future, right? Whereas some of these people, like, had a lot of money. And so they weren't worried about that. Like, their parents were paying for everything. And we're talking about these issues that are, you know, they're going to impact, like, a lot of people. So you're in healthcare, you're learning about, like, you know, social inequality and like the intersection of that and healthcare delivery and how that affects health outcomes and all of this stuff. And the whole time, I'm just looking around this room, this incredibly white, incredibly privileged. I think, like, out of the 50 people, there were, like, maybe 4 people of color, you know, and there were no Black people in my class. There was one in the class after us. And when I of course, I eventually made trouble and, like, pointed all the shit out to, like, the faculty. They weren't very happy with me. And they were like, well, there is a Black person, like, in the class after you. And I'm like, yeah, but, like, given the demographics of the city around us, you would anyway, it's not important. But the point is, like, it made me really, really angry. And I don't think I ever stopped being angry about it, right? Like, and then when I finally, you know, I finished grad school and I sat down and I was like, at this point, I had decided I was giving writing up. Like, when I went to grad school, I decided I wasn't going to write anymore. And because obviously I had no success over the last like 10 years, like, why would I keep doing this to myself? Because I hadn't had the whole realization about like the writing is the whole point. And so right as I'm like taking my boards, like I'm supposed to be studying for my boards, and I decide I'm going to try one last time. I'm going to write like one last book, and I'm going to send it into this contest called Pitch Wars. And if it gets into Pitch Wars, I'll see what happens. And if it doesn't get into Pitch Wars, I've had my sign like from the universe, and I'll never, ever write anything ever again. And I probably would not have kept that promise, but it doesn't matter because I did wind up getting into Pitch Wars, and I got mentored by two very lovely people, Victoria Lee and R.F. Kuang. And that's how I wound up getting an agent. But the book that I wrote at that time was actually like kind of like a rewrite of a book I had written many years previous. But I had taken like all of these like angry feelings that I'd had, you know, through that process of being in grad school. And keep in mind, like, I don't come from like a particularly educated background, right? Like, I am from a not super fancy place, not a super fancy economic situation. So going to grad school was very like weird for me because it was this whole culture that I had like never been exposed to with like a lot of people that I like had not, like this whole like world I had not had contact with. And so I think that's one reason maybe like I came to this whole like activism representation thing so late, because I had been very like isolated in some ways. And I just poured that all into this book, right? So I decided I wasn't writing any more books about white people, probably wasn't writing any more books about straight people, like bi people, yes, because I am bi, but definitely no straight people. And I was probably going to be writing a lot more disabled people into my books because I was tired of not being represented, right? And so like that just kind of started to like, I guess I'm just like over it. Like I don't care. Like if I don't get published or if I don't whatever, like I'm just not writing any more books that are catering to this like majority picture when that's what I've had to read my whole life. And I'm just not interested in it anymore, right? Like at the time that I wrote this book that went into Pitch Wars, there, as far as I know, there had never been an adult fantasy book set in a Korean fantasy world, right? There had been at some YA, L&O had her trilogy, but I couldn't find any, there was one science fiction, but no like fantasy book. So think about like how, like what a dearth of representation that is, right? I don't know where I'm going with this, but it's just important to me. It's like, I'm just not interested anymore in like that kind of catering, writing that material. It's not interesting to me. I don't want to explore that. And writing a book is a lot of time. It's a big investment. You're with that book alone in the morning, in the dark, usually for me, for like almost like a year of your life. I just don't want to spend time with that anymore. Does that make sense? Am I answering the question? I don't know.
Yeah, no, that was fucking awesome. Are you kidding?
Okay, cool.
No, because, you know, Sarah and I talk about this a lot. You know, we talk about how choosing to write queer characters, whether or not it's actually true that straight people will or won't read queer characters, publishing is
really...
A lot
really, of them won't.
Yeah, and publishing is very reticent to publish queer characters, and frequently when they do, it's written by straight people.
Yep.
Especially if they have graphic sex.
Yes. Yeah. Books about queer and trans people written by straight people are salacious in many cases, and they sell well in part because of that salaciousness. And so you're right. Like, there is some like, okay, well then this is it. This is like, I'm making a choice. I'm going to make a stand here of like, this is what I want to write. And, you know, we send funny texts to each other about like, I'm going to write this really straight book, and then in book two, everyone's going to come out. Which is still, I might do it. And, you know, I just think there's something really to be said for knowing what you're here to, what you want to write, what makes you, what gives you joy, and what you've seen lacking in the world around you.
Yeah. Well, I think all writers too are kind of writing to their youths, right? Mm. Like, honestly, there are tons of queer books coming out now and they're all amazing. I'm super excited. I don't read every single genre. So, but like the genres that I do read, I'm very excited to, wow, I sound ridiculous. Maybe this is part of the ones we should snip. You know, and there's lots of Korean books, there's lots of, you know, books of like different representations, but like they weren't there when I was growing up. And so even though they exist now, like my writer brain is like writing to that youth, like I can't help it. Right. And I mean, we're definitely not like there yet, I would say, like, you know, so one interesting tidbit is that East Asian ethnicities are actually slightly overrepresented in terms of total number of titles when it comes to fiction. But the quality of the representation is still pretty terrible. Like you're seeing like the same kind of three stories over and over and over again, right? One of the things that's really important to me is that Katrina is Asian, but she's also messy as hell, right? And that's, you do occasionally see messy Asian people, particularly I think in movies now you're seeing that more. Like, it's definitely something that's coming up more and more. But a lot of the time, you know, there's this, like, you know, there's the whole, like, tiger parent. There's, like, all these stereotypes that, like, people, like, kind of expect to see when you have, like, an Asian protagonist in fiction, right? And I was just like, no thanks, right? So she's messy, she's mentally ill, she's queer, like, she's just, like, a real person, you know? And I just, that was important to me, and I don't know where I'm going with this, because I'm bad at speaking.
It's so funny because you say, like, the most profound shit I've ever heard, and then you go, I don't know how to say words. I guess I'm just losing it now. And I'm like, oh my God, Maria, no, it was amazing.
I have such bad attention and memory that, like, after I've said this sentence, I actually don't remember what I said. And so then I also panic because I'm like, oh, was that sentence good? I don't know because I don't remember what I said.
I'm going to give you an A plus on all your sentences today.
Oh,
A
thank plus. You. I do like that. Yeah. Some people say I'm a writer, so yeah.
Some people say I'm a writer, so you're so funny. Oh, my God.
Oh, but I remember. Yeah. So, like, I think we're all writing to our youth. That's the point, right?
Yeah. I love that. I hadn't thought about that. And I think you're right in a lot of ways. And it's like the industry's changing and then, you know, and then it's like, There's, you know what? We aren't going to go into publishing industry madness right now.
We can. It's like my favorite tea, man. Like, I don't know. I hate talking about it and I love talking about it and I hate talking about it. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. Same. Yep. But we've had such a lovely conversation. I don't want to end there. So, yeah, you know, I think that what I find really exciting about Liar, Dreamer, Thief is how messy it is.
It's so messy.
Katrina's a fucking mess.
And yes.
I really struggle with so often this desire for queer characters, this desire for female or AFAB characters, depending on who's writing it.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about my character in my book. One of my books is like a cis woman, she thinks. And then, you know, but like the realization comes off the page. So anyways, we probably don't need all that rambling, Kate. Let me retake.
No, I would love to ramble on that topic.
Okay, ramble.
That relates to the Machado. I didn't realize I was bi for the longest time. Part of it, I think, is the lack of representation. And when you did see bi representation, this is related to Lost Girl. Remember I told you I watched Lost Girl in preparation for this podcast? When you did see bi representation in like the early 2000s, like when we were all young, like it's almost always like a very specific kind of hypersexualized, like femme for femme, femme for hot. You know what I'm talking about? Like that.
It's Beau.
Yeah. And so, yeah, exactly. It's Beau, right? That's the one kind of allowed bisexual or like, you know, the like side male villainy, queer kind of bi, but also super like Lucifer-y kind of character. Those are the two like allowed versions of bisexual. And since I didn't fit one of those, I just didn't realize, I just assumed I was straight and that I just sometimes like slept with women or like found women attractive, but like all straight people did that. I really do that a lot. I've got to stop doing that, right? Like just assuming. So I think that, but like, I think, you know, I think if there had been a lot more fantasy, for example, that showed bi characters or queer characters that I could relate to, I would have realized like, oh, I'm queer, but I didn't until I was like almost 30. And by that point, I had, you know, had like dates and relationships and sexual experiences with women and just kind of assumed that that was, everyone did that. So I think, yeah, I think that this question of like representation and like having this like messy queer character for me was obviously like me being like, if someone like Maria is growing up right now, here you go. Like, you know what I mean? Like, this is another kind of queer that you could be. And I'm actually working on a draft of a book right now. Well, I was, and then I had to work on this other thing, but I'll be back to it soon. Where I think a big piece of it is just kind of like having like a queer relationship where the assigned female at birth people aren't necessarily that like hyper sexy Killing Eve type of queer, you know, like where are my butches at in popular movies? You know what I'm saying? Like you just don't see it and I want to see more of it. So that's one thing about TikTok I really love. I make everything about TikTok. This is amazing. I'm watching myself.
You're in the TikTok zone.
Yeah. Like, so I recently got TikTok. It has, I fought it forever because I thought it was evil because like, you know, I read all of the propaganda around it and it turns out it's like no more evil than any other kind of social media. And probably like people thought it was evil because they didn't understand it because like old people don't understand TikTok, right? Like I'm old. It took me a while to understand TikTok. But now I love it because I am exposed to so much queer content. My whole feed is just queer as hell. And it's like queerness that is more representative of like queer people out in the world. Like you see a lot of different like styles of dress and ways of talking and like different relationship pairings and people with different like queer identities that you just don't see like on like Netflix or whatever, right? Like they're not as commonly portrayed in popular media. And so it was like a real like bombshell for me, right? Watching this and being like, ooh, I'm turned on by that. I'm like, what is this? What is happening to me, right? Like, I wish there had been TikTok when I was young because I probably would have figured some stuff out like way earlier.
Yeah, that makes me wonder because, you know, everybody's like, oh no, the kids are all trans and queer now. And it's like, lots of feedback to give people who say that. But one of them is like, yeah, because they can see queer and trans people and they can be like, oh, is that, there's a word for what, I didn't even know there was a word for what I am. I thought I was just like everybody else. And I think that that's like, I don't know, so fucking cool.
Essie, don't all straight women just sleep with women sometimes?
I'm pretty sure. Yeah. No, I read that in the book. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nope. You're bi.
It was a big surprise. I was like, oh. That wasn't even like a word when we were young. Like you were either gay or not.
Yeah.
You didn't get to be bi.
Oh yeah. That's like when I found out the word non-binary and I was like, excuse me. Like there's a word for everything that has been wrong with my life and everything that's made everyone furious at me since I was a very small child. That's interesting.
I'm not furious at you. I love you.
Yeah, well, you know, you're not everybody. You're Maria. I mean, it's interesting. It's I think it goes back to like what we've been saying about like word good people is like, you know, it's important to have language for ourselves, you know, and you know, I'm not always the person who needs a perfect label because I don't think there is one for me. Like I don't think non-binary solves all my problems, but I think that that word really helped me see why certain disconnects exist. It helped me see that actually, there is a whole community of people like me. And it's the same way bisexual was for me. And I don't know. I think it's neat to be people, all three of us, who are part of the world and part of that creating stories that show people like us who are noble, who are shitty, who are both at the same time, who are heroic, who are little scaredy cats, who are shitty to their girlfriend, who are amazing partners, you know, like that breadth of what it means to be alive. Because quite frankly, I've probably been all of those things at one point in my life. I'm sure I've been a garbage ass motherfucker to be in a relationship with. And I know that right now I'm like, great to be in a relationship with because I hear it a lot. And, you know, like there's just, I know my partner's the best. But, you know, I guess there's just what I feel when I read Liar, Dreamer, Thief is that this is the story I've been waiting to read and I didn't even know it.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to cry.
Oh, my God. I'm already crying. Why would you do this?
Because it's the end of the podcast. I love to make the guest cry. But yeah, I mean, I think that there's these moments where I'm exposed to things I'm not familiar with, like the Korean concept of Han and learning about that grief and being like, oh my God, there's a whole nother level to the book now that like I didn't, and it gave me that feeling of like I'm seeing something so real and so messy and so special. I really think it's an incredible work. And I'm proud of you as my friend. I'm proud of you as an author. And I, you know, it's so, oh my God, you're on our podcast talking about your book. Can you believe it?
Well, I can't make any words anymore because
I was like, that escalated quickly. Like when we first saw you, it was a short story. And now here we are.
Yeah.
But it's only been like 2 years.
It's not even a full, no, it's been 3 years since we, it's been
3 years.
2 years and 6 months since we published The Deck. And here you are.
I honestly have no idea.
Like, yeah, of course you don't.
No concept of time. Like, sorry.
I was looking at the calendar time in the corner and I was like, oh, right. Well, Maria, oh my God, thank you for being here. You're amazing.
Oh my God, thank you for having me. Like, I'm sorry I talk so much.
What? That's the point of the podcast.
I know, but I feel embarrassed.
It would be very awkward if you did not.
One day I'll come on your podcast and not talk, and we'll see how it goes.
Why?
We'll see how it goes.
Why would you do that?
It sounds fun. It sounds like a challenge to me. I'm like, you're on, Maria.
Are we all trying not to talk, or is it just you?
I don't know, but I don't, like, let's be honest. It would go, like, 4 seconds, and then I would open my mouth.
I know, so, that's like, what I'm thinking.
It's like...
I'm like, let's give it a try.
Well, Sarah, I know you, I started to close, but I realized that you haven't had a chance to ask your signature final question.
Well, I think we did talk a lot about a bunch of the things that you have coming up, but I'd love to hear, is there something that is just on the tip of your brain and you're just kind of looking forward to giving it a try, some kind of like new method or like something that you haven't been able to do in any stories so far?
Yeah. So the thing about publishing time, and you all know this, but I'm saying this for the benefit of your readers, is that it's so elongated, right? So like Liar, Dreamer, Thief was sold almost 2 years ago, and actually it's coming out early. It originally was supposed to come out in April. And then I finished all my edits really fast. And they were like, oh, I guess we can move your date. So that's perfect, right? Like ADHD, hyper-focused, and here was the book. So I wrote that book, and I actually wrote another book. And then I like got halfway through another book. And so the book I wrote after this book was very, very complicated. Like there's a lot of moving pieces. It's multi-point of view. It's kind of like literary-ish, gothic-ish. I say ish because you know me, I'm just like ramming stuff from whatever genre I feel like, wherever I want to put it, bisexual all the way through. So I just like, I like, I'm writing one now that I wanted just to write something that felt a little easy. Like it was like just one point of view and it's like kind of like, it doesn't have to be like a super imaginative plot, you know, like the tension comes from like, are these people going to kill or have sex? I don't know. Right. Like, I actually don't know because I don't know my books ahead of time. I'm a total pantser. And so I have no idea. But so I'm really excited to just do something that feels like a little bit pleasurable and isn't so complicated and like, quote unquote, like, I don't know, artistic or whatever, because I was trying really hard with that last book to do something that for me was very intellectually difficult, with a lot of like big themes and stuff. And so like, I'm really excited to just have fun with a manuscript. Like the main character is, I think she's a serial killer. I want to say she's like a magical serial killer. And there's like this other serial killer who also might be magical, but in a different way. I'm not really sure, right? Like, I don't know yet, but it's just like a sexy, fun sort of murdery. I don't know. Like, you know, I just wanted to have a good time. Like, I'm excited to just... relax and have a good murdery sexy time.
Out of context, that is a very alarming thing to say. In context, yay, I can't wait.
Everything I say is alarming out of context, like honestly.
Everything
all the time
I say is alarming out of context.
It really is. There are definitely places where like in a manuscript I send over, like I don't connect all the dots and my editor underlines something and she's just like, I look at what she's underlined, I'm like horrified. I'm like, oh man, that doesn't make any sense and it sounds really terrible. Yeah,
I think that's the process of being edited. It's like, oh, ow, but also good point.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
This has been amazing. Thank you so much. You know, I know you're a super fan of the pod, so it feels really cool to have you on as a super fan. Obviously, we've known you forever. We got to publish your first short story.
I know. That's magic. I didn't even make that connection, like sitting down and you were like, yeah, and then we published your first, and I started crying like immediately. I was like, oh my God, yes. It's like, you know, cyclic, it's closed by return.
It is.
Like, I don't know.
It's a full circle. Yes. So thank you for being here. You've been hilarious, delightful, insightful. We've cried, we've laughed, we've, you know, done the whole thing. We've raged, you know, it's been an incredible, incredible time.
I'm so glad I didn't mess it up.
Oh yeah, so it was close. I was like, oh, Maria, if you say one more word, I'm going to be so mad. That's a joke because you did great.
That's okay. It's like my whole life. It's fine. It's normal for
me. I shouldn't have even joked that way. What am I thinking? But you know, thank you so much for being here. Sarah, always love you. You're perfect. Monica, we love you. We miss you. Hope you're having fun. Kate, thank you for making us sound good. We appreciate you so much. Listeners, thank you for being here. Please do make time to go check out Liar, Dreamer, Thief. Pre-order it now. Give Maria that bump she needs right there at the end. We're going to have links to buy the book.
Period.
Maria, if people want to find you online, obviously start with TikTok, but tell us where folks can find you.
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter at Maria Dong Writes. Dong is spelled like a penis or the sound a bell makes. I don't know why I'm trying to come up with like all the things that are Dong, but that's fine. At Maria Dong Writes. I'm on Instagram at Maria_Dong_writes because Instagram hates me and won't let me verify my original handle for some reason, and I'm locked out forever. And I'm on TikTok at Maria Dong Writes, I think. I don't know, but I'm pretty sure that's correct. You can also email me at maria@mariadong.com. I have a website, mariadong.com. Basically, just type the words Maria Dong into a search engine. You'll probably find me.
Nice. All right. Thanks for being here.
I can't believe I said dong like a penis. I don't know why that came out. Like, wow.
You're listening to Bitches on Comics, distributed by Realm, your portal to another world. Listen away. Find more shows like Bitches on Comics by following Realm on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at realm.fm.
Thank you for listening to Bitches on Comics. We are a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Twitter at @BitchesOnComics and on Instagram at @BitchesOnComics. Our website is, brace yourself, bitchesoncomics.com. If you go there, you can listen to any of our episodes, and we've got other shit that we put on tabs. I don't remember what it is. I am in charge of updating the website, however, so good luck.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also support the podcast by joining us on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/queerspec to learn more.
I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm Essie Fleenor. You can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @SE_Fleenor.
I'm Monica Estrella Negra, and you can find me at www.audreysrevenge.com or on Twitter at @AudreyRevenge.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Church Fire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.